Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Conflicting narratives and competing agendas. This is the tragedy of the Syrian conflict. Western media coverage is focused on forcing political outcomes. In the process, the truth is often overlooked and even denied. Another casualty of war. To Crosstalk Syria, I'm joined by my guests, Jonathan Steele in London. He's an international affairs commentator. In New York, we have Daniel Lazar. He's an author and freelance journalist who writes frequently about the Middle East and Eastern Europe. And in San Francisco, we cross to Scott Bennett. He is a former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer and counterterrorism analyst. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I very much appreciate it. Jonathan, you're a noted journalist. You have a very long and distinguished career. What in the world has happened? Particularly in this conflict, we could look at other conflicts in the world, Ukraine, and you've talked about that on this program here. But I'm calling this program the media's Syria, because in Western media, primarily in the mainstream, they have a paradigm about what's happening in that country right now, and it is very much at odds with reality that is happening on the ground. It is a propaganda war from what I can see. How did it happen? You've been in the business a long time. Go ahead.
Well, I think it's partly because there's a sort of romanticism about rebellions against any government. It started with the Arab Spring. Well, of course, it started decades ago, but in recent times it started with the Arab Spring. Anybody who's protesting against a government like in Cairo and Tunis is automatically supported, and that's now been transferred to Syria. So the people, the rebels in Aleppo, are treated as the good guys with the white hats and heroes, and nothing they do is wrong. And anything that the Russians or the Syrian government does is automatically wrong. I mean, look at the story of the U.S.-led coalition's attack on the Syrian government positions near Deir ez-Zor, when at least 62 government soldiers were killed. That story died in about 2 hours. I mean, if it had been the other way around, you can imagine we'd be still talking about it 3 weeks later.
Well, we'd probably be talking about how Damascus looks like one huge crater. I think that's what we'd be talking about. Scott, if I can go to you in San Francisco, and thank you for getting up so early to join us here today. One of the great myths that, and it's perpetuated over and over again, is the term moderate. And from what I can tell in looking at people that have been on the ground and real experts, now people that don't want to peddle a fairy tale about Western values and all of this nonsense that we hear nonstop, I mean, they all tell me the term moderate is an illusion. It's a fantasy that comes out of Western media.
Yeah, it's an amazing degeneration of the American media mind. And I would say no good journalist or newspaper has really come out of the United States since 1980. I think all the good ones stopped writing in the 70s. And you see, I'll put on my PSYOP hat for a minute. You see a coordination between the American media and the government policy. We've seen it since 9/11. We've seen it in the taking down of countries, five countries in or 7 years. And you see a media that is backing this myth that the moderates exist, and they're trying to overthrow a tyranny and a dictator that's, in Assad's case, bombing his own people. And it's complete nonsense. And I about jump out of my seat when I hear people like Sean Hannity say the Russians, the Iranians, are working with the radical Islamic jihadis. And I say to myself, that is absolutely a lie, because the Russians and the Iranians are the only ones looking for peace and stability in the Middle East. The radical jihadis are the Saudi Arabian Wahhabi Salafists that the United States has been backing, in addition to Qatar and Kuwait and all these nations that have been financing terrorism. Now, the American media, the good news is, Peter, there are thinking men and thinking honest men in Washington that are not buying the media drivel anymore. We are standing up. We're listening to a lot of sources such as RT, such as your experts in your show, and we're coming together with a different narrative. And from an emotional point, we see John Kerry, we see Obama, we see Hillary Clinton having a sort of a mental breakdown. You can tell when people lie. You can tell when they stutter.
You know, Daniel, that's a very good point. That's where exactly where I wanted to go. I mean, I watched some of the State Department briefings, and I call the press corps that show up there the stenographers union, because all they do is write it down, and there are two or three people that sometimes ask questions. I mean, how did we get to this point here? I mean, if you go off the reservation, if you don't have the right narrative, you're not going to be published. Are you worried about your career? I mean, I can tell when these people are listening to these briefings that they're not really convinced, but anyway, they write it down. Go ahead.
America has a free press, but it's a very weak press and a very unindependent press. There's a sort of a very strong patriotic impulse that the politics stop at the water's edge, and what happens abroad is the prerogative of the U.S. government. And also, I think the Middle East is such a difficult topic for Americans that they tend to defer to Washington's guidance in this regard. But there's no doubt the press has been astonishing, especially on the Syrian question in terms of its obedience to Washington dictates, little independent thought, complete marching in lockstep. It's really amazing.
You know, Jonathan, when there was the part of Aleppo was under siege, I'll use what Scott said. I fell out of my chair when they're saying that government forces, Assad's forces, are besieging the city. And it was just, the story was completely turned upside down. And I tried to look if there was any kind of corrections or anyone was going to interrogate it, and there was absolutely nothing. I mean, I can understand what different interpretations, but I mean, that's simply not facts that can be reported because it didn't happen.
Well, what about the issue of the ceasefire agreement? I mean, the Russians wanted it to be published, the one that they'd made with the U.S. The U.S. refused to publish it. Well, where's the freedom? Where's the openness? Where's the speech, freedom of speech and all that? I mean, what was the reason for keeping it so quiet? I mean, one perhaps reason is that it required certain things of the rebels. They had to separate themselves from the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda-linked al-Nusra Front. It's changed its name, of course, to Fatah al-Sham, but it's the same people with the same ideology. And they refused to separate so that there was no chance that they'd be bombed, because the agreement was that the Russians and the Syrians would not bomb the so-called moderate forces. They had to separate themselves.
Scott, you know, one of the extraordinary things in the coverage of Syria in the West is that it is the Syrian army that has been doing the heavy lifting for years, fighting terrorism. But you wouldn't get a whiff of that idea from mainstream media.
Well, Peter, it'll delight you to know that I'm going to be talking with Senator Dick Black after your show, and I'm going to bring him all the great points that you're making. He is one of the American politicians that is standing up for President Assad, and for Russia, and for Iran, that is saying these countries represent stability in the Middle East. And he's said before, what have we become as Americans where we're backing these boy beheading, women raping savages that have been causing turmoil and destabilization and infiltrating the Middle East? So these American journalists, and I would correct one thing. These journalists, I don't think we have much of a free press anymore. I think we have a press that is dominated with corporate interests, with big donors, with big money, and they follow the stream. They don't have a love of truth anymore. There's no yeah. Men of letters. There's no educated poets that really take language seriously. And as a PSYOP guy, I know the hearts and minds are influenced by language. And the American people, Peter, it should encourage you, they're very well familiar with the Russian people and the Russian culture, and I always correct people who try and label Russians Soviets.
Yeah.
No, sorry, they are the Russians, they are the Russian
yes.
people and the Russian culture, and they represent better values than most American media do.
That happened to you when you were on Press TV a couple of days ago. I'm glad that you picked up on that, because it happens sometimes. Daniel, where do we go from here? Because one of the things I find very troubling is that Iran has been demonized by the United States for many, many years. Okay, it's a generational thing ever since 1979. And then we have Russia, that used to be the Soviet Union. These are familiar enemies to a Western audience, okay? And it seems to me that paradigm fits in very well. It's a lazy way of thinking. And I saw it would happen with Scott. I mean, he was debating someone on another channel, and they used the word Soviet. And it seems to me it's just a template that people like to use. And, oh, well, Iran and Russia, their friend is Syria, so that friend must be a bad guy and against us. Go ahead.
Well, I think that that's amazing how these conflicts persist through regime changes from the Soviets to the Russian Federation. But I think that the U.S. wants to keep a tight grip on this region of the world and is very jealous of any intrusion of outside powers, especially Russia. So the U.S. is guarding it as its private turf. It's making a complete mess of things. It's a total disaster. It's destroying a country. But nonetheless, it claims the right to be able to do that in its own, what it regards as its own backyard.
You know, Jonathan, one of the extraordinary things is that if this war continues, there will be more refugees leaving the country, going to other places, into the European Union. And that's one of the primary reasons why Russia agreed to intervene legally under international law, because Russia itself will also be impacted on that. And this radicalism can go into the Caucasus. I mean, it's just common sense. But that common sense never gets translated into the mainstream media.
No, and then you've got these extraordinary statements from the man who was the head of NATO forces in Europe, Supreme Commander in Europe, claiming that Assad was, quotes, weaponizing, unquotes, the refugees. I mean, what an incredible image. I mean, somehow that Assad has control over millions of refugees and can turn them into weapons. I mean, it's bizarre.
Scott, you know, can you reflect upon that? Because, you know, there's no agency with the Syrian people. They're just subjected to terror. That's what we hear all the time. It's not true.
It's absolutely false. Now, the other alarming thing is with the degeneration of the American media, and I think you're going to have a retraction of the American military footprint out of the Middle East, because I honestly think, and I hope Donald Trump steps up and beats Hillary Clinton, because that's our only pathway to peace. Hillary Clinton wants war. I think Trump would back us away from that. But here's what's alarming. When this Syrian operation happened, which was not an accident, I know that from my experience
Scott,
in the military
Scott,
and the
Scott,
intelligence
Scott,
services.
Hold that thought. Okay, gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on media coverage of Syria State with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing how media covers the Syrian conflict. Okay, I'd like to go back to San Francisco. I had to jump in there. Go ahead, Scott. You can finish your point.
Well, when you had the Syrian operation where the Americans bombed and destroyed the Syrian forces with A-10s and F-16s, you simultaneously had operations within the United States, which people in the community and the psychological warfare and military environment have looked at as coordinated operations to delude and detract the American consciousness away from Syria into the United States. And specifically, you had a bombing in New York, you had a disruption of a Marine Marathon parade, you had 60 schools in Canada evacuated, all supposedly because of domestic disturbances. Now you've got a Black Lives Matter shootings. They do this to distract Americans away from Syria, away from the Middle East, away from the United Nations potential war crimes tribunal for declarations of war, away from the fact that the United States bombed with Mossad and Israel, bombed the other convoy with laser technology. Americans don't see that because they're distracted by the media to these other alternative information sources. That shows me, and many, many others, that the American media cannot be trusted. The alternative media that is rising up has much more sway on people. But I think in the long-term geopolitical interest, as the American footprint begins to pull back from the Middle East, you're going to have an increasing domestic disruptive state in the United States. And, you know, it doesn't bode well for the United States. But I would also end it by saying Vladimir Putin has a great opportunity, as does Iran and China. They have the opportunity to appeal directly to the American people. You can't trust John Kerry. He's a liar. You can't trust Samantha Power. She's a liar, as is Barack Obama. But they can write a general letter to the American people in the New York Times, the Washington Post, saying, "Dear American people, we do not want a war. If you don't want one either, vote with your heart. Vote to stop these wars. Vote to reject the candidates
that want those wars. I really
wish the American people would support it.
Well, Vladimir Putin had an op-ed not long ago. I think it was in the New York Times, and it was a good op-ed, but it was completely vilified by everyone because they don't know anything about Russia. But let me go to Daniel here. One of the things I find really extraordinary, and I think this is the media's fault and maybe American education and ethos when it comes to foreign politics, but in 1 week's time, during the course of 1 week, Obama ordered bombings or drone attacks in 7 different countries in the world. And this is a Nobel Prize winner. But Americans don't even flinch about that. I mean, the American activity in Syria specifically is against international law. It's a gross violation of sovereignty. But Americans are never taught to think in those terms. And that's why they don't flinch about it. Because, oh, that's what we do. That's simply what we do. In the 1960s, it was the American media that tipped the balance against the war in Vietnam. But I see the media now is just in lockstep with power. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, first of all, Peter, I want to emphasize that that there's no evidence of any broader coordination where the U.S. Military is somehow arranging the shooting of black people in Charlotte, North Carolina, or that somehow Mossad is involved in the bombing of the convoy in Aleppo. That, to me, is just crazy talk. The things are bad enough, but the problem in the U.S.
is that
the U.S. policy is in total shambles in Syria. Various agencies are working across purposes with one another. There are signs of conflict between the Pentagon and the State Department, possibilities of sabotage, of each one sabotaging the other's operations. It's a shambles. It's not a well-coordinated intelligence operation across the board. It's just a shambolic, farcical operation. And about the American people, I think that you are being a bit unfair.
Okay.
The American people are not enthusiastic about these adventures. They're not enthusiastic at all. They have lost faith in the ability of the American establishment to run these operations. They think that these imperialist adventures are getting nowhere. I think that's one reason why Trump is as popular as he is, and why Clinton just seems to be such a hollow person who's just repeating the same old tired line that somehow the U.S. is winning the war against ISIS when the American people know that it really isn't. These forces are growing more and more powerful. And
yes, but
the
I mean, but Daniel, but I think I think it's really crucial also to point out is that the American people are not aware of the backing that certain American intelligence agencies and administrations are backing up the bad guys here. And I mean, if you were to explain to them who these people really are and take out the word moderate, I would hope that they would be appalled, but they're not told that. I mean, read every major broadsheet, American allies in the region, American-backed rebels. I mean, they used this fictional language here. I mean, if they knew who those people really were, then I think that maybe they would be a lot more questioning. But if you don't know that, then why would you question? Go ahead, Daniel.
The American people know all too well that they live in a huge oligarchy where the people themselves have little control over foreign policy. Listen, Obama is going to veto the 9/11 justice bill, which will allow the victims of 9/11 to sue Saudi Arabia, or at least to investigate Saudi Arabia's involvement. It's a travesty. It's a shocking injustice. And this is not lost on the American people, but they don't know what to do about it. They're at a loss. Their government is out of their control. They don't trust it. They don't believe it. They think it's incompetent, but they don't know how to bring it back under control. So therefore, they turn the news off and they put on the ball game or whatever. But I think the American people are not at all happy with the way things are going.
You know, Jonathan, is this a phenomenon because Obama is such a weak president when it comes to foreign policy? I mean, he has his underlings. I mean, contradicting him in public, a different agency saying what different agendas they have. And we have Ash Carter here that says, no, I won't back the ceasefire. I mean, and I have the power. I can force it, you know, the ceasefire agreement not to come into play. I mean, is this a function of the deep state of what's happening here and we're just seeing behind the veil, or is it because Obama is just playing golf?
Well, I think he has shown himself to be weak on this point that you've raised about Ash Carter. I mean, a previous president of the United States would have sacked the defense pact immediately. You can't publicly oppose a key issue of foreign policy like what's going on in Syria. So that is a sign of weakness. But, I mean, the other thing is there's a basic contradiction which they've never resolved, which is who do you support in Syria? Is it the Syrian government or is it the people who tried to topple the Syrian government, whether it's IS or the so-called moderate rebels? They never seem to get that right. One minute they're saying, yes, Assad can stay in power a bit longer. Yes, he represents some sort of secularism and some sort of stability and some sort of protection of minorities. But on the other hand, he's a brutal dictator who bombs his own people and so on. They keep getting themselves caught in these contradictions. Well, of course, there are certain contradictions in any foreign policy. But you have to finally get off the fence and say, look, do we support Assad because he stands for more better things than the other side, or do we support the other side? They're trying to have it both ways. They somehow want Assad and the ISIS people to disappear like a puff of smoke or the wave of a magic wand. It's not going to happen.
You know, Scott, I find it really tragic that a lot of media always tries to look for virtue, and when politics is not about virtue, unfortunately, it's a different species here. But you know, Scott, you know what? Just recently, John Kerry is calling for a no-fly zone, and during with the ceasefire, I mean, it was an amazing step. The Assad government agreed, because Russia was going to back it up, that certain areas there would not be any planes. Okay, that was part of the deal. Now Kerry's saying, after the Americans bomb Syria and kill Syrian troops, now he wants this again. And I went through all the major papers before we came and convened here today. And when I first read this, I thought, well, my goodness. I mean, now the United States will be official air cover of ISIS and other terrorist groups. But as I was reading all the broadsheets, nobody came up with the same conclusion. But mine is the obvious conclusion. But no one there is talking about it. This is what I'm getting at. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind, there's in a military frame of mind, you have a goal, you have objectives, you have strategy, you have tactics. The goal of the United States since George Bush, carried under Obama, has been U.S. hegemony over the world. That's the goal. The objective has been destabilization of the competitors. The strategy has been destabilizing these countries from within, and the tactic has been using the injector as human rights violations and religious persecution, playing the victim card. So there's a goal, objective, strategy, tactics that the United States has been waging against Russia diplomatically, militarily, economically, and informationally. So you see John Kerry and these other puppets starting to lie and fumble and fall all over themselves and look down at the ground and get nervous when they tell these lies. The American public don't buy it. Many of us in the military love Russia. We love the Russian personality and cultures. I worked with Russians in the military, and I have seen a lot, Peter. I saw it at the State Department. I saw it in the Army. There's a lot of horrific stuff that's causing people like me to come out and speak truth, because this isn't just about destabilizing, you know, a region. This is about threatening all of the world and civilization. The United States has caused so much chaos and havoc, it shames me. And so does it many other politicians to say, what have we become? Okay. What in the heck are we doing? We have ravaged Europe, and the way to correct it is to have good people rise up to Congress, and I will do that myself, taking this platform, and I will challenge people.
Let me go to Daniel. Position. Give Daniel here the last word here. Daniel, again, returning to the media. I mean, we had all of this coverage of the illegal invasion of Iraq in 2003, and we see it repeated over and over again. And I don't see anybody in media held accountable. Do you agree with that or not?
No one's held accountable. Assuming that Hillary's elected, we'll have, you know, one of the key backers of that 2003 invasion back in the White House, and all the major neocons will be enjoying power. They'll be drinking champagne and enjoying their power like they never have before. I want to bring back something that
we'll
you said before,
blood.
Peter. You're quite right that if Assad falls, this will be the greatest Salafist victory since I don't know when.
Oh, Daniel, I have to jump in here. Gentlemen, we've run out of time. I wish we had more time because that's a very interesting point. Many thanks to my guests in London, New York, and in San Francisco. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time.
Court, I'm Max Keiser. You know, the central banker numbskull Ben Bernanke once opined from his ivory tower, if you want to understand geology, study earthquakes. If you want to understand the economy, study the Depression. Oh, Benny, 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 so little that you know. In fact, Benny, earthquakes can tell you a whole lot more about the economy than the Great Depression can. Stacy, can you explain this to me more?
Indeed, we're going to cover that. But I just want to make a note, actually. Nobody ever is called Benny anymore, are they?
Benny and the Jets.
Well, it used to be a big name back in the 50s and, well, during the Great Depression. So I want to look at a headline here that I think is a good analogy to the global financial system, which Ben Bernanke, of course, as the head of the U.S. Federal Reserve at one point, used to be in charge of the global financial system. Obviously, he failed when the whole banking system failed. And one of the things is we're going to look at the earthquakes in Oklahoma that has shut down the fracking operations there. And
that's the third rail of content on the interwebs. Fracking.
Well, the headline reads, first of all, Oklahoma EPA shutter 32 wells in new earthquake-prone area. Oklahoma, just at the beginning of September, had a 5.8 Richter scale earthquake. If you've ever lived through earthquakes, it's a huge earthquake. It's scary. They shut down half of the fracking wells. Well, in fact, the injection wells. So I want to talk about this. In the global economy, energy is important. We need oil, we need gas, we need nuclear energy, we need energy to run our economies. Now, it's not so much the actual production of fracking, not the wells, not the digging, it's the waste product of fracking. What to do with the water. There's a lot of water required in order to extract the natural gas, in order to extract the oil. The problem with that is the water is then wastewater, which has a high concentration of radioactive waste in it and other toxins. So how to get rid of that water? That is causing the earthquakes in Oklahoma. In the financial system, you have credit. Credit makes the financial system go around and makes our economy go around. But along the way, it picks up a lot of toxic derivatives, bad debts, and this is the problem of how to get rid of all those bad debts without causing a global Great Depression. We've been papering over and papering over. So I want to look at what's happened in Oklahoma now that they've shut down a lot of these injection wells. State and federal regulators said 32 disposal wells in northeastern Oklahoma must shut down because they are too near the newly discovered fault line that produced the state's strongest earthquake.
Wait. So a disposal well, that's a separate than a fracking well.
Yes, it's a disposal well. Actually, I'll show you this chart of the U.S., well, half of the U.S. where fracking is. And all those red dots are disposal wells that have triggered earthquakes. The gray dots are other disposal wells.
But I thought they recycled the water.
They do up in Pennsylvania because there is so much radioactive waste in the water up there because of the nature of the shale, the Marcellus shale up there. So what they do is they treat the water, but it causes a heavy concentration of radioactive sludge, and then they have to find a place to put it in a dump. Here, because of the nature of the geology of their rock, they inject the water deep down, which maybe it's not going in the groundwater, but it is causing these earthquakes now.
Understood.
Obviously, that's pretty scary, but forcing oil and gas operators to stop injecting wastewater or reduce the amount they can inject means they can't produce as much oil and natural gas, which can cause a serious financial hardship, said Chad Warmington, president of the Oklahoma Oil and Gas Association. Quote, these are multi-million dollar wells in some cases that you can't operate anymore, period, Warmington said. If you take away your disposal activity, there's nothing else you can do with that water. So here you're at a standstill there. Economic activity is at a standstill. And when I'm comparing this to Ben Bernanke saying he didn't make the connection that you could study earthquakes and study financial markets, because when we try to get rid of these toxic financial derivatives, these toxic debts, our whole system also comes to a standstill. So what the financial markets have done is they continue with the fraud, the earthquakes, the ruptures, the crashes in the markets are the same as what these earthquakes are causing, financial ruptures.
So yeah, we started with Ben Bernanke, and that the financial policies that were pushing dead-end policies and causing a lot of blowback in terms of failure. You can see this happening in other areas of the economy, like in this fracking industry, where they can't really do the disposal wells anymore because it's causing earthquakes and the costs are prohibitive, so they are closing down that whole sector. However, it is heavily protected racket. It's a racket. Like central bank is a racket, it's protected. It's a protected racket. You know, in America, they get protection. It's not an economy.
Sure, and what has happened in the financial system is they don't want banks to fail. They don't want companies to fail. They don't want so they've maintained all these fractures in the system, and it could all fall apart at any moment. Now, another analogy for what this is happening in Oklahoma is, of course, you're having all these earthquakes. So prior to 2008, they had an average of 2 earthquakes per year, which were over 3.0, because there are some fault lines, naturally in Oklahoma, fault lines cause earthquakes. They went from 2 to 107 in 2011 to now 907 last year. So they're having these bigger and bigger earthquakes. People are getting more and more afraid, but they're also having damage to their properties. And so who pays? In fact, that's the headline I have here, Oklahoma earthquakes, who pays? They now have 15% of the population, that's it, has earthquake insurance. But it turns out that out of about 100 claims filed for earthquake damage in Oklahoma in 2014, only 8 were paid, according to the Oklahoma Insurance Commissioner. And in fact, according to data released earlier this year, only about 20% of all earthquake claims have had any payouts since 2010. And part of it is now these policies cost anywhere between $50 and $300 a year for the premium. But then you have the deductible, which is about up to 20% of your property value. So if your house is worth $100,000, you have to pay the first $20,000 in damage. Then the insurance will kick in. So now they're fighting the state regulators, the governor, Mary Fallon. She definitely wants fracking there because it gives them a lot of revenue. However, she also has a population that goes to the voting booth and votes and says whether or not, you know, if you've had $10,000 in damage year after year after year, you keep on having to pay that, and the insurance doesn't kick in. You become angry after a while. It starts to,
you get those revenues.
Yeah.
But not from the business itself, because the business is cash flow negative. So to get the central banking metaphor here again, so you have in the bond market, in the global bond market, negative interest rates. Mm-hmm. People are buying bonds, locking in a guaranteed loss.
Yeah.
Why do they do that? Because they think that the central banks and the commercial banks are so corrupt that they will make negative interest rates go even more negative. Like when a bank like Wells Fargo, and they're caught thousands of bankers stealing millions, hundreds of millions of dollars from customers and shareholders. They don't sound the alarm. They actually buy into it because they know that with any hostage situation that's out of control, that there's a way to profit from the hostage winning and banking on the amount of money that will be stolen from the hostage taker. So here in this business, in this fracking business, even though it's cash flow negative and it's economically unviable, people invest in it because it generates an enormous amount of fees. So if you have a piece of those fees, or whether you're the banker, they got $125 million for creating thousands of fraudulent accounts. You know, you want to be the fracking executive who's making millions and billions perpetrating an unsustainable, uneconomic, cash flow negative business.
Ironically, it's cheap credit which is driving this. And the cheap credit comes because so many financial earthquakes have been caused by toxic debt building up in the system. So in order to hide that, in order to basically provide insurance to the markets, it's caused this. Now, not all of those gas wells, obviously, are cash flow negative. Some of them are very high producers and make a lot of money. And that's an area where they do have quite productive wells. But even despite that, So you have to start adding in the long-term cost to a system where we've seen it's quite clear that more and more earthquakes, bigger and bigger quakes, that there's a sort of seismic events coming up.
No, I'm saying if you don't include the environmental costs.
Well, I'm going to, not just environmental costs. I'm going to talk, I have a quote here, and I want to look at Standards and Poor's, with they look and rate credit. They look at long-term economic costs, just like insurance companies have to factor in long-term economic costs. So let's look at this quote here. A big quake in Oklahoma would pose economic risks, not just for homeowners, but the whole state. A 2015 report from Standard & Poor's Rating Services predicted quakes linked to oil and gas production will, quote, have sharp economic consequences on real estate investment, property values, and job growth. So it's trying to get rid of the waste is causing long-term economic costs by not factoring in those costs individually on smaller scale as it goes on, whether it's in the financial sector, and as you mentioned, those Wells Fargo fraudulent accounts, it builds up into a bigger seismic event, which basically destroys all those previous decades of profit.
Yeah, exactly. The adjusted for environmental costs, this is not a very good business to be in, but because of the politics involved and the introduction in the banking sector of things like deferred prosecution. Like, we know we committed a crime, but we're going to defer the prosecution until such time as the statute of limit expires, and then we're going to walk away scot-free. And by the way, give me $100 million. The same thing applies to any other business that's being serviced by those bankers. You know, this energy business borrows from the banking industry. They see that the banking industry can commit fraud with impunity. So they're like, well, you know, we should get into the fraud business,
so,
too.
So another big sector of the fire sector, finance, insurance, real estate, is the insurance business. And the reinsurance business, in particular, has to really look at long-term costs. They were one of the first to warn about climate change because they were covering those costs. They were covering the costs for cleanup of all the hurricanes, more and more powerful hurricanes. In particular, regarding Oklahoma, they say Oklahoma quake insured costs uncertain. Swiss Re suggests new products needed. So as I said, the high deductibles mean that a lot of people don't actually get any coverage because of the high deductibles. So they're saying that high deductibles and accumulated loss from multiple stronger seismic events could become problematic for consumers, according to Swiss Re. Since deductibles are typically applied to each individual event, small to medium repeated events can build up sizable uncovered damages over time. The cost to repair those damages can be a large financial burden to many homeowners and businesses. And this is the socialized risks, privatized profits, and, you know, these are real costs to real individuals.
Yeah, and the only way to create a new product to cover the risk is to rely on the 30-year-old bull market in bonds and the cheaper interest rates. But we've already gone to negative rates. So there are no new products to cover, to paper over the shortcomings in both, in all of these industries. And
so I think what earthquakes teach Ben Bernanke is there's no free lunch.
Okay, well, sounds like Milton Friedman. All right, well, stay tuned for the second half.
Ignored a UK report on the West's lies used to justify the Libyan regime change, all the better to protect the ongoing falsehoods used in Syria, as James W. Carden explains. By James W. Carden. Earlier this month, a select committee of British parliamentarians released a report which condemned the UK government under David Cameron for its role in the 2011 NATO intervention in Libya. The report makes plain that the principal basis on which the intervention was predicated, that then Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi was on the verge of committing a wholesale slaughter of the rebel stronghold Benghazi, was a lie propagated by Western and Gulf state media outlets. It also shows the extent to which the crisis was driven by Libyan exiles who perhaps quite understandably had an axe to grind with the Gaddafi regime. In this and in other ways, as we shall see, the Libyan crisis shares a number of similarities with the Syrian crisis. Indeed, it would be fair to view the debacle in Libya as a dress rehearsal for the war outside powers have been waging against the sovereign government of Syria for the past 5 years. The UK report documents the extent to which the narrative of impending genocide was driven by the delusions of Libyan exiles. Libyan exiles based in France were influential in raising fears about a possible massacre in Benghazi. Visiting professor at King's College London, Professor George Joff, told us that the decisions of President Sarkozy and his administration were driven by Libyan exiles getting allies within the French intellectual establishment who were anxious to push for a real change in Libya. Indeed, the UK Select Committee was told that émigrés opposed to Muammar Gaddafi exploited unrest in Libya by overstating the threat to civilians and encouraging Western powers to intervene. The narrative crafted by Libyan exiles was swallowed hook, line, and sinker by a willingly credulous Western press. Similarly, dynamics were at play during the initial phase of the crisis in Syria. Professor Tim Anderson of the University of Sydney notes that Syrian clerics in exile in Saudi Arabia, like Sheikh Adnan Arour, called for a holy war against the liberal Alawi Muslims who dominated the Assad government. The journalist Eva Bartlett, who has been on the ground in Syria, has written that the problem with many of the Western media accounts of the Syrian crisis is that many talking heads draw from one sole source, UK-based Syrian Rami Abdul Rahman of the so-called Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, SOAR. Abdul Rahman, who runs the oft-quoted SOAR out of his home in Coventry, England, hasn't, according to Bartlett, been to Syria for 15 years. What is more, Abdul Rahman's operation is reliant on the reports of opposition figures. This, as Bartlett notes, is no impartial source. Other exile groups, like the Syrian National Council, has received millions of dollars in funding from the declared enemies of the Assad regime like Qatar and UAE. Meanwhile, regime change groups like the Aleppo Media Center, AMC, the Washington-based Syrian Expatriates Organization, CO, have, according to Anderson, received hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations from unnamed sources. Professor Anderson tells us that like many other U.S. created front groups, the Syrian Campaign, the White Helmets, the CO is committed to the overthrow of the Syrian government. That also happens to be the aim of the United States government. Machiavelli was perhaps righter than he knew when he wrote, "How dangerous a thing it is to believe those who have been driven out of their country, such as the extreme desire in them to return home, that they naturally believe many things that are false and add many others by art." And then there is the role Western media has played in ginning up the twin crises. The UK report on Libya citing Amnesty International notes that Western media coverage has from the outset presented a very one-sided view of the logic of events, portraying the protest movement as entirely peaceful and repeatedly suggesting that the regime's security forces were unaccountably massacring unarmed demonstrators who presented no security challenge. In fact, the opposite was the case. Security forces in both Libya and Syria came under attack by Islamist radicals from the very start. These were hardly the peaceful protests as portrayed by the Western media. As the UK report points out, it is now clear that militant Islamist militias played a critical role in the rebellion from February 2011 onwards. What is more, the possibility that militant extremist groups would attempt to benefit from the rebellion should not have been the preserve of hindsight. Libyan connections with transnational militant extremist groups were known before 2011, because many Libyans had participated in the Iraq insurgency and in Afghanistan with Al-Qaeda. Likewise, The dominant myth surrounding the Syrian crisis is that millions of peaceful Syrians took to the streets as part of the liberalizing wave which roiled the Arab world in the spring of 2011. Human Rights Watch declared that the Syrian protesters only used violence against the security forces as a last resort. Indeed, all of the violence which soon unfolded was said to be the fault of Assad's police state and Assad's subsequent refusal to step down, so the story goes, as one of the main causes of the growth in strength and numbers of radical Islamist terrorists. As recently as last summer, none other than former Prime Minister David Cameron called Assad a recruiting sergeant for ISIS. And while this claim is as nonsensical as it is disingenuous, it is a line which has been dutifully echoed by former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who in April told CNN that ISIS was primarily the result of the vacuum in Syria caused by Assad first and foremost. From the very start, the opposition to Assad included sectarian extremists who chanted, "Christians to Beirut, Allah is to the grave." And the first documented incidents of violence in Deraa were against, not by, the Syrian security forces. Professor Anderson cites an Israel National News report from March 21, 2011, which told of 7 police officers and at least 4 demonstrators in Syria have been killed. Anderson notes, the armed forces came to Deraa precisely because police had been killed by snipers. Emphasis mine. The journalist and analyst John Rosenthal translated a January 12, 2012 report from Homs by a Dutch Jesuit, Father Frans van der Lugt, who was later murdered, likely by al-Nusra militants, in April 2014. The Jesuit missionary observed that most of the citizens of Syria do not support the opposition. You also cannot say that this is a popular uprising. The majority of people are not part of the rebellion and certainly not part of the armed rebellion. What is occurring is, above all, a struggle between the army and armed Sunni groups that aim to overturn the Alawite regime and take power. From the start, the protest movements were not purely peaceful. From the start, I saw armed demonstrators marching along in the protests, who began to shoot at the police first. Very often the violence of the security forces has been a reaction to the brutal violence of the armed rebels. Also inconvenient to the dominant narrative is the fact that even after the large-scale anti-government protests and escalation in violence, 55% of Syrians polled in 2012 wanted Assad to remain in power. With all of this in mind, we would do well to treat reports from the likes of CNN's Clarissa Ward with a healthy amount of skepticism, not least because the fact that Islamists were involved from the very start of both the Libyan and Syrian uprisings have been relentlessly excised out of the dominant, acceptable mainstream narratives like hers. Lost alternatives. When one considers the policy alternatives which were rudely shunted aside in favor of violence, the twin catastrophes in Libya and Syria appear all the worse in retrospect. Instead of strictly adhering to the unmandated arms embargo in Libya, the UK Select Committee reports that we were told that the international community turned a blind eye to the supply of weapons to the rebels. Lord Richards, UK Defence Chief of Staff, highlighted the degree to which the Emiratis and the Qataris played a major role in the success of the ground operation. Likewise, the Syrian arms embargo was only selectively and fitfully enforced. From May 2011 to June 2013, the EU imposed an arms embargo on Syria but, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, by April 2013 the EU decided to allow the supply of certain equipment to Syrian opposition forces. In the ensuing years, the United States aided and abetted the supply of weapons, laundered through Jordan, to radical opposition groups, while Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia were the principal suppliers of weapons to ISIS. As Meredith Tax of the think tank, Center for Secular Space, recently pointed out in The Nation, the United States continues to turn a blind eye toward the actions of NATO member Turkey, which is supporting jihadi gains by attacking Kurdish forces in northern Syria. The media, as Tax correctly observes, has failed to look hard at the Erdogan government's support of jihadis, or to ask what they have in common. Meanwhile, diplomatic alternatives were never seriously pursued in Libya or in Syria, though it is true that the peaceful Russian alternative to Obama's red line policy was pursued with regard to dismantling Syria's stockpile of chemical weapons. But a peaceful path in Libya was, it seems, never taken seriously. Saif Gaddafi's attempts to broker a settlement with the Clinton State Department and with the UK through his intermediary, former Prime Minister Tony Blair, were never taken seriously by NATO principals. As the UK report tartly notes, political options were available if the UK government had adhered to the spirit of Resolution 1973. Implemented its original campaign plan and influenced its coalition allies to pause military action when Benghazi was secured in March 2011. Political engagement might have delivered civilian protection, regime change, and reform at lesser cost to the UK and to Libya. And given the behavior of both Gaddafi and Assad in the years following 9/11, the sovereignty of both countries should have at a minimum been respected. After all, Gaddafi had only just begun to accede to Western prerogatives, as when he abandoned his WMD program in 2003, while Assad had cooperated with the Bush administration in its so-called global war on terror. It is worth noting that in doing so, he earned the enmity of the religious fanatics who run Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. As thanks for his cooperation, the United States, ever at the beck and call of the Gulf state autocracies who are our actual enemies, Assad has become the target of regime change enthusiasts in the United States and Europe. Their designs have wrecked large swathes of Syria, resulted in an unprecedented migrant crisis, destroyed the lives of many millions, gave rise to ISIS and strengthened the very same Islamist radicals who attacked us on September 11 and who remain the sworn enemies of the West.